Hello, and welcome to episode 49 of the Story Hack Podcast. The Story Hack Podcast features action, adventure, and mystery stories, mostly from the public domain. Story Hack is also a print magazine which publishes new action and adventure stories in a wide variety of genres. Visit storyhack.com today for more information. Today we will hear Red-Headed Decoy by Don Cameron.
Red-Headed Decoy by Don Cameron. The black sedan approached Coon Lake as casually as though it brought holiday-minded passengers to that middle-class summer colony instead of grim men whose flaring nostrils anticipated smells of scorched cordite and new blood along the brown road that skirted the water between lines of flimsy cottages overflowing with yellow laplight and amplified radio blare. It moved unhurriedly until it reached Jasper Coon's general store and dancing casino, where it turned in and stopped a little apart from a dozen other cars. Six men and a red-headed girl occupied the sedan. Bob Logan, local chief of operatives of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, switched off the ignition and looked with inquiring gray eyes at the girl who occupied the front at his side. Logan was a man of about 33, with dark, crisp hair below his pearl fedora and above a chin and mouth that might have been chiseled out of granite, notwithstanding the customary friendliness of his expression. Even behind the wheel he showed up tall and big across the shoulders. "It's your move, Kitty," he said to the girl. Kitty Morgan did not meet his eyes. She stared straight ahead apprehensively, her cheeks pallid except where Rue splotched them. She was supposed to be the sweetheart of Dutch Treat, kidnapper, but actually she loved money more than any one man. She expected to depart from Coon Lake that night the richer by at least $10,000, which was the total of all rewards posted for Treat and Joe Desiro, his pal, and possibly with the extra $10,000 offered for the capture of Vinnie Shocker, their hell-inspired leader, also. Moistening her livid lips with the tip of her tongue, and inclining her dyed head toward the row of cottages they had just passed, "Kitty," Morgan said softly, "it's the third cottage from the end. The sign over the door says Restful Roost. The shutters were closed when he went by, but I could see lights through them. Dutch and Joe are sure to be there, and one of them will be watching the road all the time." Logan regarded her curiously, wondering what kind of conscience made her willing to betray men who trusted her for the price of a mink cape and a diamond or two. He asked in shock her, "I already told you I don't know anything about him. Nobody knows where he hides out, but he's close by, because Dutch hears from him almost every day. And Dutch said Vinnie was going to stop by tonight to divide the heckler money." Logan's lips tautened to a straight line as he thought about the heckler money. Vinnie Shocker and his gang had collected $75,000 from relatives of Adolf Heckler, the brewer, who had been kidnapped from his home after his bodyguard had been murdered. Shocker experienced no difficulty getting the money because the G-men deliberately ignored the case, mindful of Shocker's reputation and his threat to slice Heckler into little bits if there was any interference on the part of the authorities. Now, 3 days later, Heckler was still missing, and the official supposition was that he had been killed anyway. Logan twisted around in his seat to face the men in the rear of the sedan. Three of them sat shoulder to shoulder, and two were huddled uncomfortably against the floorboards, concealing rifles and a brace of ugly submachine guns, so that the car would not appear overcrowded. The middle man sitting up with Fred Parker, chief of the four-man police force at the neighboring village of Coonsville. Parker, bald and floridly pink, was the first to speak. "I gather," he said dryly, "we're after Vinnie Shocker's boys. It's about time I was let in on it. You should have told me in the first place, so I could send some men down to help." "Your three men wouldn't help a lot," Logan pointed out. "We have all the angles figured. We didn't want to ignore you or rob you of glory, but we had to make absolutely sure there was no leak of information, accidental or otherwise. There's a chance we may grab Shocker. You ought to be glad to be in on it." "I'm glad," Parker said. "I wasn't squawking. I just thought I should have been told sooner. Now that we understand each other, I'll take orders. What's the plan?" "We're going to cover all sides of the hideout," explained Logan. "Pierce and Pulaski will go to the cottage across the road. Ferris will go to the one this side. If there are people in those places, make them go down cellar. If there are cellars, so make whatever arrangements are possible for their safety in case of shooting. Borum, you slip around behind the cottage on the other side and keep under cover. I'll take Chief Parker with me and knock at the front door to find out just how restful a roost it really is. Got it straight? There was a chorus of murmured assent, in which everyone but Parker joined. The cop had gone a shade paler, but he did not speak. Desirio will be wearing false whiskers and sitting in a wheelchair, pretending to be an elderly cripple, Logan continued. Treat is supposed to be a male nurse and probably will be wearing a white jacket and pants. Is that right, Kitty? She nodded nervously. That's the way they've done the past 2 seasons they've hid out here. I don't know about Vinny. I never saw him. None of us have. Logan snorted. Damnedest thing I ever heard off a crook getting away with kidnappings, bank robberies, and cop killings for 3 years, and not a decent picture of him on record since he was a kid of 15. Plenty of witnesses and people who have seen him, but all they can give are descriptions that usually don't agree. I'd note him if I saw him, said Pierce, picking one of the submachine guns up and thrusting it out of sight beneath his coat. I went to school with him in St. Louis. Even if I didn't see his face, I could smell him. He was always a skunk smooth and cruel and dirty. Pierce opened the door of the car and got out. He and Pulaski strolled away together, not hurrying. After a minute, Ferris and Gorham followed. With their weapons hidden, their hands thrust into their pockets, they looked like any other young men visiting Coon Lake for a party in somebody's cottage. The luminous hands of Logan's wristwatch pointed to 10:05. Through the windows of the casino, open to the warm night, came the cluttered music of a swing tune, and about 20 couples could be seen on the dance floor. Out of the general store section of Jasper Coon's establishment came a tall, dignified figure, clad in black and wearing a dark felt hat and a clerical collar. The man's hair showed white under the hat, and an ebony cross swung upon his chest. He carried a paper sack that might have contained groceries. Parker leaned out of the sedan window as the man came near and said respectfully, "Hello, Dr. Witherspoon." "Hello," the man greeted, walking to the car and peering within. "How are you, Chief?" "Hello, Miss Morgan." Kitty nodded to him jerkily and turned her face away, as though the presence of a clergyman awoke some sense of shame within her. "Logan," Parker said, "this is the Reverend Dr. Witherspoon. He has spent the last 2 summers at Coon Lake, and I guess he knows everybody that comes here." "At least," Witherspoon said, "I generally know something about them. Already I know something about you, Mr. Logan. Having seen you arrive with the other men, and seeing you now in the company of our local champion of law and order, I am convinced you are an officer of the law. If betting wasn't a sin, I'd lay 2-1 I can name the people you came here to see." "How would you know that?" Logan asked, startled and a little annoyed by the interruption. "Miss Morgan is with you. She spends a great deal of time at the cottage called Restful Roost. Being interested in the souls of the people I am among, I have called at that cottage. I have noted that the old man, an invalid, is neither as old nor as helpless as would appear at first glance, and that his male nurse isn't as professional in his bearing as he might be." His voice grew suddenly stern, accusing. "I have noticed, too, that Miss Morgan is not making the best use of her life." Kitty gasped audibly. "I haven't done a thing wrong. I'm only out riding with Mr. Logan. If he's a cop, I don't know it. And if there's anything wrong about those men and the cottage, I don't know anything about that, either." She appealed to Logan. "Isn't it so?" "I've given you my word," Logan said. He had promised to shield her from any possible attempt. Shocker, or his pals might make to revenge themselves upon her for betraying them. "We're only a couple of innocents having a look at the moon. I thought maybe you'd like to ask Dr. Witherspoon some questions about the place or the people," Parker hinted.
"No," Logan replied, "but I'd like to ask him a favor. You won't tell anyone else about your deductions for a few minutes, will you, Doctor?"
Witherspoon laughed. "I probably won't even speak to anybody else tonight. I only tell my deductions to detectives I happen to meet anyway, because I think detectives ought to appreciate them. I know my Sherlock Holmes almost as well as I know my Bible." He waved good night and strode on up the road. Logan got out of the car. "You stay here, Kitty, and you'll be out of harm's way," he said. "Parker, that's the reason I didn't tell you anything sooner. You talk to too many people. It isn't good to do that when you're on a job like this." "I only thought he might help you," Parker mumbled. "Maybe he's seen Chalker around or something. He's a smart old bird for a preacher." Kitty was evidently suffering pangs of premature remorse. She twisted her handkerchief into a hard ball with her thin hands, and her features worked. Suddenly, she blurted out, "I wish I hadn't told." "Too late to back out now," Logan told her, not unkindly. "You shouldn't feel bad anyway. But she has no more conscience than a mummy, and your information will do society a real service." "I don't care what he is," she cried, bursting into tears. "I loved him, and he was good to men away. I don't want to see him killed." Logan considered. "Parker, you'd better stay with her," he decided. He grinned to himself. "I know you'll be disappointed to miss the fireworks, but you'll get some credit for the arrest anyway, and somebody's got to see she doesn't get hysterical and gum up the works." "All right, he'll stay." Parker tried to sound reluctant, but his expression of relief was comical. He got out of the back seat and sat in front, beside Kitty. "Now, behave yourself," he commanded with unwanted sternness. Logan walked toward the cottage where Treat and Desirio were living under assumed names and characters. As he walked, he hefted the big service automatic strapped against his vest below the left shoulder. All four of his G-men had taken up their posts and were out of sight, and the house across from the marked cottage lights blinked out. Farther along the road, the Reverend Doctor with a spoon was turning leisurely into a path leading to a tiny, rustic house. Nearing the restful roost, the seasoned operative was aware of a tonic tingling along his spine, a bracing of all nerves and sinews against the unexpected. He welcomed it. It was like gambling to a devotee of that fatal pastime. It obliterated everything except the anticipation of fate's next move. It sharpened every sense and instinct. Logan found a fierce happiness in danger. The unexpected came with a flash of lightning and a clap of thunder when Logan was barely 10 feet from the porch of the cottage. Blue-white flame streaked in a thin line from between two veins of a shutter, and Logan's hat flew from his head before his ears heard the roar of the gun. His hand was swinging loosely at his side. Without conscious direction from his brain, it swept up and snatched the big automatic. Even as he crouched, making his body a small and swift-moving target in the dusk, he sent two chunks of government lead smashing into the shutter close to where the other bullet had emerged. A surprise cry reached his ears. He reached the shelter of a big elm half a dozen yards from the front of the cottage before any other shots were fired. Then they seemed to come all at once from all directions. The men in the cottage were shooting at him and at the house across the road. From that other house, where Pierce and Pulaski were fortified, burst pistol flashes and a stream of thundering fire that poured out of the muzzle of a submachine gun. One thing was clear to Logan in the midst of the confusion: Dutch Treat and Joe Desirio had not been taken unaware, and blood might be spilled plentifully before the law took its hostages. Three questions formed in his brain as he worked the trigger of the pistol, hammering hot slugs into the facade of the kidnapper's hideout. Was it because the outlaws had been admirably vigilant? Was it because one of his own men had bungled and given their presence away? Or had there been a tip-off from some mysterious source? Bullets were ripping the cottage to pieces. A crossfire from three directions pierced walls and windows. From behind the place, where Gorham was hidden, came the deep-throated sputtering of a second submachine gun. Ferris was firing two automatics from a window of the house next door. Shattered by Pierce's shots, one of the front shutters sagged crazily on its hinges and swung open. The glass behind it had been shot out of the window frame. Logan had a glimpse of a figure scurrying for shelter and snapped the bullet toward it. He took a round object, the size of a small orange, from his pocket and tossed it through the window. As he did so, a bullet tugged at his sleeve and seared like the touch of a branding iron as it grazed the skin of his arm. Back of the window, Logan saw the white mist of tear gas filling the room. In a minute now, the rats would have to come out. If they came out without guns, well and good, they would have a slim chance for their lives in court. If they came out shooting, it would save the state money. A ruddy glow beat against the clouds of gas visible through the window. It grew rapidly more brilliant. A great tongue of flame leaped into sight. Either the kidnappers had fired the cottage themselves, or one of the bullets had started a blaze in some manner. Across the road, Pierce came out of the front door of the house, his machine gun clamped firmly on the crook of his arm, spraying all bullets across the front of the cottage. The clip ran out, and the G-man reached in his pocket for another. All at once he staggered back, put a hand to his forehead, and dropped in a heap. A stout, bearded man and a man in white trousers and jacket came running from the door of the cottage. Each had a gun in either hand. All four barrels blazed toward the tree behind which Logan crouched. Splinters and chips of bark struck his face as he ducked back. At his right, a burst of shots came with ear-splitting violence. Ferris had come around the corner of the house unobserved. Risking a look, Logan saw the whiskered man drop his weapons and sink to his knees, his face twisted in agony and both hands pressed to his belly. In the lurid glare of the mounting fire, crimson blood oozed between his fingers. That, Logan knew, was the finish of Joe Desiario. The man in white, Dutch Treat, appeared to be unwounded. He dropped his guns hurriedly and lifted his hands high. "I've had enough," he yelled. "Damn your yellow guts, I can't fight the whole army." At that instant, Kitty Morgan, her red hair flying, ran out of the shadows and flung her arms around the outlaw. "Dutch," she screamed. "Geez, I'm glad they didn't kill you." Treat's face writhed with hatred. He lowered his right hand, put it over the girl's face, and pushed with all his strength. She reeled across the lawn and fell heavily a dozen feet away and lay there, sobbing bitterly. "You filthy squealer," Treat shouted at her. "If I'd known you were around, I'd have got you before I gave up." He moved toward her, as if to do her further harm, but Ferris and Logan were already at his side, grasping him. Ferris clicked handcuffs on his wrists. Flames wrapped the cottage, leaped up above the roof. Through the open door, Logan saw something lying on the floor. He went so close that the heat scorched his face. The thing was the body of a man, his clothes already smoldering. Beside the body lay a bundle of three or four round, yellow sticks, the thickness of a man's thumb, with a tiny brass cylinder among them. "Get back," he yelled. "The place is loaded with dynamite. It will go up in a second." Panic seized the 100 or so people who had gathered around from the casino and other cottages, staring open-mouthed at the scene. They ran for cover, some of them screaming in their fear. Ferris hustled Treat along the road, while Logan grasped Desiario's arms, although he suspected the man was already dead, and dragged him out of the cottage yard. The cottage split apart with a terrific roar. Flaming chunks of wood were hurled through the air like rockets. The ground shook, and eardrums were numbed by the concussion. Logan turned on Treat. "It's a dirty shame nobody got killed, isn't it?" he inquired acidly. "Just for that, I'll make extra sure you go to the chair. If I have to open up every murder case in the last 5 years to hang it on you in case some miracle gets you off in the heckler business." "Who was in the cottage?" "Vinny Shocker," Treat said sullenly. "Your first bullet got him in the heart." "Where's that money Shocker was to bring you?" Treat grinned bitterly. "Burned up or blasted to hell," he replied. "Vinny had it on him, I guess." "What happened to Heckler?" "Treat said you got me wrong on that." "I wasn't in it. Vinny and Desiario did it all alone when I was in Montreal on a drunk, and they never did tell me about it." A tall figure pushed past Logan and knelt at the side of Desiario, lips moving. His hand felt for a heartbeat. He looked up to meet Logan's steady gaze. "He's gone," said Dr. Witherspoon. "You never gave him a chance." "There'll be trouble about this. The public won't stand for shooting men down in cold blood, even by government agents." "Pulaski came over to them," Pierce and Gorham are both dead, he reported. A bullet cut Pierce in the brain. Gorham was behind the cottage when the wall fell on him and burned him to death. What do you think of that, Witherspoon? Logan asked coldly, but the reverend gentleman did not answer. Kitty Morgan had come near them and was looking tearfully at Treat, and Witherspoon was glaring at her as though she were the devil in a dyed wig. Chief Parker had run so far when he heard there was dynamite in the cottage that, walking back toward them, he reached the sedan at the same time Logan and his two surviving G-men did. I thought Treat started to run with the rest of them, he explained. I chased a man half a mile before I caught him and found he was one of the old residents of Coonsville. That was brave of you, Logan observed. Do you think your jail will be strong enough to hold Treat for the night? I was going to take him into the city, but we're all pretty tired, and I guess we'll put up at the hotel. One of your cops can sit up to guard him, can't he?
Sure, Parker said. It will be good publicity for the town. I'd sit up myself, only I haven't been feeling very well lately.
I thought you looked a little shaky, Pulaski put in, his voice heavy with sarcasm which Parker missed altogether. They made a phone call, and half an hour later the Coonsville undertaker called with an ancient hearse for the bodies of the three dead men. Watching the bodies of Pierce and Gorham placed in the long wicker baskets, Logan clenched his fists and his teeth. He wasn't a vengeful man, but there was a lot of mopping up to be done yet to make certain those two fearless agents of the government had not given their lives in vain. "We'll come back in the morning," he told Pulaski and Ferris. "The fire will be cold then, and we can see if anything's left that can be used as evidence.
The body will be blown to bits, I suppose, but there may be some method of identifying it.
We'll have to do that before we can declare Shucker officially dead." He walked over to Parker, who was standing beside Dr. Witherspoon, and lowered his voice so that the bystanders couldn't hear him. "And you'll have to keep a close watch on Treat, Chief," he said. "He gave me the high sign a minute ago, and I think he's willing to bargain. If I can get him some assurance that we'll go easy on him, charge him with anything except first-degree murder, break down and spill everything. We've got to count on something like that to be sure of winning in court." Parker nodded. "How about the girl?" he asked. "Want her in a cell, too, to make sure she sticks around to testify?"
"No, I'll take care of her."
When he turned around, he saw that she was whispering to Treat. The prisoner's eyes still glittered when they looked at her, but he was listening to what she had to say. They'd have to watch her, Logan told himself. They could thank her for finding the right and left-hand men of Shocker, but if they gave her half a chance, she'd get Treat free again. Queer, unpredictable creatures, women were, never knowing their own minds. Treat cursed them horribly when they locked him in one of the two cells of the Coonsville jail. "You better watch me close," he jibed. "I could bust this cracker box wide open if I had 10 minutes alone." To see that he did not have that much time to himself, Parker placed a pale, reedy, elderly man in the corridor where he could watch the cell. The man's name was Charlie Bell, Parker said, and he was one-third of his police force. Bell had a revolver half as long as his arm strapped to his side, but he didn't look as though he could use it.
"Better let me stay, too," Pulaski suggested.
"It would be rotten if he got loose, after what he did to Pierce and Ferris." "No," Logan said and yawned. "It's after midnight, and we need our sleep. We'll go right to the hotel and get up early in the morning."
He didn't intend to sleep himself. He had a hunch that he wanted to follow out, but he wanted to do it alone.
If more than one man was prowling around that night, it might spoil things by tipping off people who shouldn't know about it. In the rambling old summer hotel at Coonsville, Logan picked a room for Kitty Morgan on the third floor, with only a single window high in one wall. He locked her inside. He put Pulaski in the room on one side and Ferris in the room on the other, with instructions to sleep with one eye and one ear open to be sure she didn't get away. Then he took a room for himself on the second floor, where the windows overlooked the small brick building that was police station and jail combined, and sat down to watch, after switching out the lights.
Coonsville had settled down for the night.
Only an occasional light blinked in a house, and an occasional automobile purred through the main street. Logan thought about Vinny Shocker, that phenomenal, reckless, fast-thinking youngster who might have risen to a position of fame and respect if he had chosen to live within the law instead of giving free rein to his perverted instinct for cruelty and love of arrogant defiance to society. He wondered if the body who had been in the burning cottage was really Shocker's, or if it was a corpse provided just to throw the G-men off the trail of the body of Heckler, perhaps. Chief Parker strolled importantly down the main stem and waved to somebody inside the owl lunch room, which stayed open all night for the benefit of anybody who'd be abroad when the rest of the world slept. Was Parker too disturbed by the night's events to sleep? Logan wondered. A car stopped in front of the owl, and a tall, slender man got out and lingered a moment in seemingly casual conversation with Parker, then went into the lunch room. Logan stiffened at the sight of the tall man. His eyes narrowed to hard slits. He let himself through the window, clung to the sill with his hands, and dropped 6 or 8 feet to the soft earth of a flower garden. His drop jarred him, but it was soundless. He made sure his pistol was in its place and started toward the jail, taking care that Parker, who continued his walk 100 yards away, could not see him. Concrete steps led upward to the door of the police station, which was half open. The windows were too high above the street level to permit a view of the interior, but when Logan climbed up the steps and peered around the door, he saw that the front office was deserted. A door behind the counter that cut the office in half led to the cells, and Officer Charlie Bell sat tilted against the wall on the other side, so close to the door that his right hand, holding the edge of an open newspaper, could be seen. Logan crossed the room on tiptoe. He listened near the inner door and could hear the rattle of the guard's paper and an occasional rustling sound as Treat shifted his position on the plank bed. It was not a part of his plan to make his presence known, so he looked around for a place of concealment and chose a spot under the counter close to a desk, where, crouching on hands and knees, he could not be seen unless a person came right up to him. He had hardly made himself comfortable when he heard quick footsteps coming to the door and entering the office. The tap of high heels proclaimed that the visitor was feminine, and Logan knew it was Kitty Morgan. He was not surprised that she should be coming here, but he wondered how she had managed to get away without the knowledge of Ferris or Pulaski. He had not thought she would have the nerve to lower herself from the window on a rope made of blankets, but he was soon to learn that she had more nerve than he gave her credit for. She came inside the counter, where he could see her around the desk, and her face was pale and determined. Bell heard her and lowered his paper and got up to stand in the doorway. Smothering a yawn, Bell said, "Hello, miss. What can I do for you?" She said, "Give me the key to that cell, and be damn quick about it." And she emphasized her words by jabbing forward a tiny, pearl-handled automatic she had snatched from her handbag. Officer Bell's mouth sagged in ludicrous surprise. He started to reach for the big gun at his side, then thought better of it and held his arms away from his body. A scared look came into his eyes. "You ain't juckin'?" he quavered. "I ain't," she said, mimicking his tone. "I'll blow you loose from your shoes if you don't step lively." Hopelessly, Bell reached out a trembling arm and unhooked a huge steel ring from a nail under the counter. 2 small keys dangled from it. "I don't know which is which," he said. "You'll have to try 'em both." "You mean you'll have to try 'em? Get in there and unfasten that cell door." The 2 of them disappeared from Logan's view. The G-man got to his feet hurriedly and went to the doorway. He heard Treat's surprised greeting. "A baby. Just let him turn around here so I can get that cannon he's totin'. He won't be needin' it half as bad as I will." Logan peeked around the doorway just in time to see Treat appropriate the guard's gun. Logan swore silently. It looked very much as though he was going to have to step in and take things in hand, and if he did, it would spoil the thing he had planned. The cell door swung open. Treat stepped out, swung the big gun viciously, and brought it down on Bell's skull. The officer slumped, but before he fell, Treat grabbed him by the front of his coat with 1 hand and thrust him savagely into the cell, then clanged the door shut and locked it. "That'll keep him out of the way for a while," Treat growled. "And now, sweetheart, You're going to get your sin. You ain't never going to sing to the law again, or nobody.
Dutch, she pleaded. They made me talk. Didn't I risk my neck to save you? Haven't we had some good times?
Good times. The kidnapper snorted as his left hand closed on her throat.
Why, you good time teams come at a dime a dozen. If you thought I cared a damn about you, you were nuts.
He raised the butt of the revolver above her head, poising it for a blow that must certainly have killed her.
Keep it up, Logan said, stepping into sight, and put the other one up beside it.
And drop that rod.
Treat cursed luridly, his shoulders hunching and his face a mask of baffled rage. But he obeyed. The big gun clattered to the cement floor.
Kitty Morgan, afraid of the throttling grip, sat down hard and began to cry.
Shut up, Logan commanded her. I don't want any noise. I'm expecting somebody to show up any minute.
He kept his pistol pointed at Treat's chest. You can get your hands down long enough to hand me those keys, he said.
I'm going to put you in the other cell and keep watch myself to see that nobody lets you out.
He reached with his left hand for the keys, which Treat thrust forth ungraciously.
His eyes were riveted upon the outlaws, watching for some trick.
He could not watch Kitty at the same time, and did not see her draw back her leg and kick viciously at him. The point of her high heel struck him square on the ankle, driving a streak of hot pain upward through his leg. Overbalanced as he was, leaning forward, it staggered him, and he nearly fell. And just as he lurched, fighting to remain upright, a gun roared, not his own, and not the tiny weapon which Kitty had dropped when Treat grabbed her. The shot came from the outer office, and the bullet chipped paint from the cell bars, chest high, in front of the space Logan's body had occupied a split second before. At the same instant, Treat sprang upon the G-man and bore him to the floor, knocking the pistol from his hand, but not before Logan had glimpsed the two men in the outer office, Chief Parker and Dr. Witherspoon, the former with an expression of blank surprise upon his face, and the latter with a smoking pistol in his right fist. Among other things, the trainers at the FBI school in Washington had taught Logan a jiu-jitsu trick or two. When he went down, face forward, he bowed his head and shoulders and arched his hips so that Treat hurtled on over him, striking the wall. They regained their feet at the same instant, and Treat, dodging a whistling right hook, clinched with Logan. For a moment the two men swayed back and forth, locked together, their strength and weight so evenly matched that neither could hope for an early advantage except by a surprise trick. Out of the corner of his eye, Logan saw that Kitty had risen and picked up the guard's huge revolver. Holding it in both her small fists, she pointed it at Logan's head, not 3 feet away. Logan shut his eyes, summoned all his strength, and whirled out of the line of the barrel a tiny instant before the boom and flash of the weapon came. He felt Treat go suddenly limp. Opening his eyes, he discovered that the bullet had torn away a whole section of Treat's forehead, where it had emerged after entering at the back of the skull. Logan lowered the dead man to the floor. Still bending, he saw the feet and knees of the man in Churchly garments before him, and sensed what was coming. With a fierce elation in his heart, he lunged at the knees and wrapped his arms about them, hardly noticing the bullet that scorched along his back. He lifted mightily, pushing forward with his shoulder at the same time. Dr. Witherspoon's feet came up, and his shoulders and head went backward and down, thudding against the concrete. His body went limp. Pulaski and Ferris ran into the station, pistols drawn. They halted at the sight of Chief Parker sprawled on the floor, his head gashed where the barrel of a gun had struck him, and beyond, the motionless forms of Treat, ghastly in death, and Witherspoon.
The girl got out by the window, Pulaski explained breathlessly. I happened to look out and see the knotted bedsheets dangling. When we got downstairs, we heard shooting and came on the run.
Logan grunted.
It's lucky she did get loose. She wanted to help Treat, but she wound up by killing him, which goes part way toward evening things up for Pierce and Gorham.
And without meaning to, she saved my life by kicking me just as Shocker shot at me.
Shocker, Ferris exclaimed. Where in the devil?
That's him.
Logan nodded toward the recumbent Witherspoon.
Remember the descriptions we had of him tall, slender, dark, and educated. He only dyed his hair and changed his clothes.
And what a difference it made, Pulaski muttered. What put you wise to it, boss?
Well, Logan said, all our information indicated that Shuko was somewhere close, where he could keep in constant touch with Treat and Desirio. They were disguised, so it was logical to suppose he was, too. He'd have to be able to come and go without arousing suspicion.
Witherspoon came to Coon Lake 2 seasons ago, when the others did. When we met him tonight, he knew too much about the men we were after to be just a good guesser. And somebody warned them about us and Witherspoon. Alias Shocker was the only one who looked us over and then went near the cottage. He gave some secret signal. Later, he was indignant because Desirio was killed, but he didn't have a word to say about Pierce and Gorham. The genuine preacher is always on the side of the law, and this one wasn't. He had a grudge against Kitty, too naturally enough, since it must have been plain she was the squealer. But even so, I only had a hunch. That's why I wanted Treat brought here, instead of taken to the city. I wanted to see if Witherspoon, alias Shocker, would try to spring him, out of friendship or for fear he would talk too much. And Shocker did, giving himself away. He talked Parker into bringing him into talk to Treat, having Parker completely fooled, as well as Kitty. And when he got inside and found me here, he had to slug Parker and go after me. Then whose body was in the cottage? Eckler's, beyond a doubt. They had that angle all figured, too. They had a corpse to dispose of and a leader to hide. They soaked the cottage with gasoline and had it all set to burn in case of a raid. Treat and Desirio, if they were taken, would say Shuko was the charred corpse. Then the heat would be off him, and he'd be free to help from the outside, and there wouldn't be any corpus delicti in the Heckler case. The man with the reversed col monde and opened his eyes. He stared about him blankly. Dutch, he called.
Joe, where in hell? Realization of what had happened came to him. His eyes blazed hatred at Logan. When I'm squatting in the hot seat, he rasped, I'll go out with a curse for you on my lips.
That's okay, Logan murmured absently, feeling the pain in his ankle and the searing wound along his back as he limped toward the cell door to release Officer Bell, who had regained his senses. Your religion and mine are so different, Shocker, that the curse will probably work backwards. Unlocking the cell, he paused to look at Kitty. She leaned against the wall pathetically, a red-headed, rouge-splotched ghost. Her china-blue eyes were dull, staring at the huddled shape of Treat. The G-man felt genuine pity for her. She could get years in prison for this night's work, and yet, had it not been for her, Shocker and his gang would still be preying on innocent men and women, leaving murder and ruin in their wake.
Listen, Logan said to Bell, if the papers find out you let a girl stick you up, they'll laugh you out of your job.
But if you don't say anything, neither will I.
Golly, Bell said, touching his scalp gingerly, that's swell of you.
I won't say a word.
Logan turned to Kitty. Our friend the preacher spoke the truth tonight when he said you weren't making the best use of your life. Why don't you take it to heart?
You'll get 10,000 in rewards. That's enough for a new start. What do you say?
Her eyes looked up and widened. A light of hope came into them, softening the hardness of her face. She whispered tremulously, I've always wanted to travel and meet decent people. I'd like to take a trip around the world.
If you really mean it, G-Man, all I can say is thanks a million.
This is the end of episode 49. Thank you for listening. If you want to support the podcast, please visit storyhack.com.